This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3163 for Wednesday, the 16th of September 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws Season 1 Episode 13, The Road to Communism and Freedom, and is part of the series Linux in Laws. It is hosted by Monochromek and is about 64 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, our old heroes discuss their legacy and how they arrived at open source software and communism.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Is Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open-plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35, or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux in Laws, Season 1, Episode 13, The Way to Communism and Freedom. Martin, how are things?
Hey, Chris, things are great if slightly warm.
How come?
Unlike the usual UK summer, the weather has decided to do something odd, which is called heat, which we don't see very often here, but it is, slightly melting.
Okay, fair enough. Same here, actually. We're looking about 40 degrees, I suppose, on a good day. On a bad day, it's more like 30-something, but that's okay, I suppose, given the current climate change we're experiencing, never mind the pandemic. But let's not talk about this. Before we come to our main subject, which is the road to communism and freedom in general, and yes, we are talking about open source, let's do some news. What do we have in store, Martin?
Well, I have a news item, which is related to our topic, in fact, which is that Have I Been Pwned is going open source as well soon.
I read this, yes.
Hmm. So, I mean, this is obviously something that a number of companies have done. A main example in my history being Pivotal, which when it was formed, open sourced all their VMware products like Gemfire and Greenplum, etc., etc. So it looks like many people are seeing the benefits of this model.
I reckon in this particular case, basically, it boiled down to the fact that he tried to think about monetarizing this, as in kind of putting a business model around this, but failed to do so, and finally came to the conclusion that because apparently he was close to burnout or something, at least that is my perception reading bits and pieces about it, at least he came to the conclusion that he cannot do this alone anymore, and this is the more or less the primary reason, let's put it this way. why he decided to go public with this in terms of open sourcing it.
Yeah, this BDFL model seems to be unadopted for a number of projects in the recent history, hasn't it?
A certain NoSQL database comes to mind.
Yes. Our Greek friend Salvatore has also done the same.
For those few remaining listeners who do not know what we're talking about, full disclosure: we both used to work for Redis Labs. I'm still working there. Martin has decided to defect to a closed source company. I hope Martin can live with the pain, but that's okay.
Open source components. <it's fine.
laughs> Exactly. So essentially what they do is, I can say this, right, Martin? We can still cut it out later. Maybe not. Apparently what they do is, when I'm looking at the website, the tech stack seems to be pretty cool. They are taking open source components and wrapping this in a proprietary software package. Essentially the idea is to put parts of a Postgres engine onto a GPU architecture, which is way cool, I might add, and probably the way to go forward with regards to beating the last bit of performance out of a database architecture. The trouble is basically it's a closed source company, but hey, this is it. Maybe Richard and friends will come finally to terms with it and kind of open source the whole company. And I'm sure that Redis Labs or some other company will be more than game to make an offer. Maybe not.
Interesting concept.
Full disclosure, this is pure belief. This has no commercial background. This is pure speculation, people.
I'll give you a quote from today, specifically relevant to this topic.
Disclose, Martin.
In-memory database is going to be obsolete in the near future. GPU databases will obviously overtake them. So
maybe. People, the emphasis is on maybe, not will be. There's a difference. So let's see. Anyway, okay.
Yeah.
Do I have anything of...
Yes,
of,
what about of your news? Sorry.
As a matter of fact, I don't have any apart from the heat wave.
Okay.
And
not the D wave. No. Okay.
Not D wave, just heat wave, yeah. Okay. And of course, yes, Emacs 27 point something will have improved font support.
Okay.
Yes. That hit just the news Emacs yesterday. Yes.
Out there,
exactly, exactly.
All five
exactly.
of them.
And of course, Halfbuzz, which is the underlying library, will only really shine on GUI systems, as in graphical user interface. Of course, hardcore Emacs users don't use graphical user interfaces because they are diehards living by the command line. So this is a bit of a contradiction in terms, I suppose. For the hipsters out there, fair enough. With version 27, you can look forward to improved font support, but to the rest of us oldies and kind of old people, let's put it this way, there's no point in denying this, it'll be business as usual with regards to this particular font
green
support
and white,
aspect.
Is it?
Yes. It's actually, yes, green on black, or black on white, or amber on
amber,
black,
yes,
if you're
amber
so inclined.
Who needs colors, eh? Yeah.
Indeed, who needs colors? there's a recent... I can recall coming across a recent survey about, a couple of months ago, that apparently X point something percent of the male IT population, as in people doing IT for a living, like programmers, architects, and so forth, are colorblind anyway. So it doesn't make a difference.
Well,
who cares?
Are they colorblind before they started in IT, or is that as
yes.
a result?
Yes. Colorblindness, as we probably all know, is more or less a hereditary disease, so there's no real choice in the matter.
There's some certain statistical manipulation going on here, I'm sure.
Nothing that can be that can't be fixed, Martin. Okay.
Okay.
If we're done with the news, let's move on to our main topic, which is, of course, the road to communism. And let me shed some more light on this.
Oh, wait.
Yes.
Wait.
Sorry.
Hang on.
Yes.
There is more important news. The more important news is that we are on Google Podcasts.
Yes. Martin, thank you.
The most important.
Okay, we're recording this on the 11th of December, August. 2037 or something. Yes, after about a delay of about, 20 years? Make that actually, 17 years. Google has finally decided to accept us into the podcast realm. No, jokes aside, if you're listening, fair enough. It took some time, but you finally got around. I appreciate the great effort your crawling bots have put into this. Fully appreciate it, don't get me wrong. It only took so much time to put up a proper RSS feed and a small hint.
You mean little time, surely?
Little time, yes. Small time, whatever. Long day. And Google, if you are listening to this, there's certainly room for improvement on your website, but more on this during the POX of the week.
Excellent.
Another teaser, yes. Okay, back to communism and the road to it. The following 6 hours, 30 minutes, and 7 seconds will be spent on two OAPs, and of course OAP standing for Old Age Pensioners, or Old Age Pensioners, whatever they call it in the UK. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
I don't know about you, but I'm still working for a living, so I'm definitely not a pensioner.
You probably have to do that for the rest of your life, no? Maybe not. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We are digressing. Yes, the idea is basically
like
to
shed
some
in our terminology.
The idea is basically to explain a little bit about how we arrived, not just at open source, but maybe also to some extent explaining why we do this podcast. For want of a better explanation of this. So, Martin, why don't you get us started?
Yes, okay, sure. So, the road to open source. Now, road to open source for me was really purely coincidental, as in a non-conscious decision like yourself, I expect. Since my background is has been in closed source for many, many, many years, and
full disclosure, Martin used to work for Oracle.
Only very briefly when it was still a nice company. Yeah.
You worked there for 2 months. Excellent.
Slightly long. Where this is way back in 1990. Even before that, too long ago, in fact. But yes, it was still a nice company back then. And in fact, I should have bought some shares at the time, but I didn't. So it's these things. Yes. So okay. So closed source, fine. And for me, the road to open source was really around. Obviously, everybody started to use Linux in more anger as its main open source component, right? Now, that was probably the first thing that most people in IT came into contact with in terms of open source. For myself, obviously, being in the particularly in the database arena, that was my introduction to open source, right?
And that was around 1992?
no, strangely enough, the organizations of the world were all very happily buying closed source software, mainly because of its status, reliability, support, etc. Where you know, people in sandals that wrote a few lines of code in their basements were frowned upon in those days.
So when did you use when did you first use Emacs? And don't say yesterday, because that doesn't count.
I think that would be never, since I am a long-standing VI user.
Okay, given the fact that VI is open source as well, when did you first use that, what's it called again? It's not an editor, it's something more...
It's many great things.
What's what I'm looking for?
I don't know.
Sorry, no, stream editor is taken by SED, but... tool, yeah, let's put it this way. When did you start to use ED's successor called VI?
Yes, you had to switch the editor in those days, didn't you? Indeed, because the default editor was ED. So interesting enough.
Sorry, Martin. Just wondering, was there any paper tape involved?
No. Sorry, surely VI is post paper tape.
You straight went to TTYs, as in teletypes.
No. At university, obviously, I used paper, but that was more DEC.
You used paper. I thought you were younger than I am.
Well, I guess my university was a little bit underfunded, so they couldn't afford too many terminals.
You used paper tape at uni.
Mm-hmm.
Are you serious?
Yeah. In a way, that's a good learning experience.
Come on, you went to uni what? Late 80s, early 90s.
Yes, late 80s or mid 80s.
And that was in Africa or still in the Netherlands?
In the Netherlands.
Full disclosure, Martin went to a university in a Dutch colony in Africa. We just found this out.
Let me think. No, I don't think we have any African colonies.
Are you sure?
Colonies in the Indies and in one in South America.
There's still this kind of islands. Hidden gem in Africa that really nobody talks about because... Let's not talk about this. Anyway... But you went to university in the Netherlands to a Dutch university. Can you disclose the name?
Yeah, Universiteit Twente, of course.
Twente used paper tapes in the late 80s. Are you joking me?
Yeah, this could have been the museum, but it may have just been a quick exercise. So for our lab work, we used to use the paper terminals instead.
And you did labs in the museum, okay.
No. This was a cold data center. Yeah.
In a museum.
With lots of space. With lots of space in it as well, which is considering today's data center.
Twente had a data lab in a museum. Okay, please elaborate.
Well, it's anyway. Sorry, let's go back to my fun fact before.
apparently, Martin can't really talk about this.
Considered an OAP. Yeah, so fun fact is that I think we started with 150 students the first year, and I think after the first semester, did we have semesters or trimesters? Mm. Anyway, after the first term, there were about less than half left, and after the first year, there was probably only about 25 of us, which was kind of curious.
Late 80s, computers are in the Netherlands, okay.
Yes. Yes.
Given the fact that Amsterdam is to be considered a digital hub of Europe, I'm just wondering where this came from.
Yes. No. Technical hub. I mean, this is all about the fundamentals of computer science, right? You don't have to have all the latest technology to become a computer scientist. It's all zeros and ones at the end of the day.
Fun fact, Martin.
Unless you're using a quantum computer, of course. they didn't have those in those days.
There's at least two big exchanges in Europe, as in internet exchanges, as in peering points, as in major peering points. One of them is about 4 miles south of where I'm living in Frankfurt, and the other one is in the Netherlands.
Excellent.
And you're talking terabits of data here.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind these cool hipsters in Amsterdam that have been telling me for the last 20 years what to do in terms of the next digital wave. So the Netherlands certainly has a reputation for being quite digital. Maybe that just developed in the 90s, but...
Well, we are quite an advanced country, but, to learn something, it's quite useful to understand all the basics, right?
I see. Sorry, I didn't. Full disclosure, I didn't want to put Martin on the spot. Now, don't get me wrong. But I'm just curious.
No, you haven't succeeded anyway. To be fair, this university is right next to the German border, so that may have something to do with it, I suppose.
I can recall Twente to be quite an advanced school. In terms of natural sciences, and
Never mind computer science. Of course, computer science is not a natural science. Goes without saying.
Well, it had a. Okay. So in the Netherlands, there are three technical universities, right? There is Groningen, there's Delft, and there's Twente. And
what about Amsterdam?
That's not a technical university.
Tannenbaum taught there.
Yeah, but as a university as such, it's okay. More known for its other subjects than. So, you know, the likes of the Twente, Delft, Groningen, they specialize in maths, in science, in math, in physics, in computer science. They had one business studies study, and that was it, right? It's all focused on that. Whereas at your Amsterdam's, you'll get psychology, philosophy, languages, all that kind of nonsense. And that's what those universities are better known for as your technical universities. You know,
okay. Very
specific on those topics. So you get a lot of nerds together, basically.
I see. Interesting. Okay.
And what about your own university experience?
It's been a while. Okay, to cut a long story short, I went to... In Ireland, they call this Regional Technical College. It's not a university, it's rather a more practically oriented school.
Yeah, it would be called a polytechnic.
Polytechnics, yes, in the UK. Because at the time I had the impression I wouldn't survive a couple of semesters at uni, so I went to that polytech straight away with the idea of maybe doing a master's after my bachelor if I felt like it. So the school I went to, in American terms, of course, the Polytechnic is called Fulda. And this is basically where I got my first exposure to open source. To some extent, let's put it this way. But also, much more importantly, to something called Unix. And we are going back around 35 years, give or take, because... I managed to hold on the first system administrator job around 86. Mm-hmm. And then it all went downhill afterwards. The school decided to buy something called an RTPC 6150, which was the first 6150 in Germany. Sorry, it's been a while. The 6150 used to be... the first commercially available RISC architecture on a PC platform from IBM, running AIX of sorts.
AIX, yes.
Yes, and I was the system administrator of the first German import on that machine. So me and Unix go back about 35 years, give or take. And even while I was at university, I always kind of did jobs that involved Unix or some related operating systems in one fashion or another. For example, I did a couple of stints at companies including Philips, probably known for the bulbs, being a Dutch company. And Philips Communication Industries, all the rage before they were bought by Alcatel, I think, in the late 80s, had a major subsidiary down in Nuremberg. And this is basically where I did a stint programming it was communication board device drivers for Linux kernels. And funny enough, that was my first major exposure to open source in terms of running open source on a proprietary Linux system, on a proprietary Unix system rather, which was Solaris. Mm. Then a spin of BSD, and I was looking for some sort of editor, and in 87 I came across something called Emacs. So I pulled down the source code, to my amazement. It then compiled on Solaris. I can't even remember the version that it was. Probably more like 4.1 or something, I don't know, which was close to a BSD system. It compiled out of the box. I didn't have to do much tweaking. And then I had a version of Emacs running on in my account, compiled with a proprietary C compiler, but it worked out of the box more or less.
What was the... the editor of choice on Solaris in those days?
I can't remember. It was probably VI or something. I don't know.
Obviously too complicated then, I guess. Yeah. Was that the reason for Emacs?
Probably, yeah. You see, yes, VI has its advantages, let's put it this way, but Emacs just, it's just a better approach at editing text. VI has a smaller footprint read, but even Vim and friends are okay, let's put it this way. I mean, I know my way around VI, but I was at the time I was looking for something much more powerful. Hence, I came across Emacs, and given the fact that VI was part of the Solaris distribution, Emacs wasn't, as far as I can recall. I simply put down the source code, ran the install script, more or less. And given the fact that there wasn't an internet around as we know it back in the late 80s...
Where did you pull this source code down from?
I think it was UNET or something. I can't even recall. It all basically worked out of the box without much tweaking to be done. Let's put it this way. The next thing, of course, then I decided to do a PhD... After concluding my master's here at the University of Bonn. For this, I went to a school called Trinity College. It's in Dublin, as in Dublin, Ireland, where we developed an experimental microkernel similar to L3 and other gadgets in that area. And that was the time when we came across something called Linux. We're talking about 93, 94, 95, 96. I can recall installing a kernel version 0.9 something on an Intel PC, 386, with, I think, 64 main memory or something like this. Maybe it might have been more. But I was even then thoroughly impressed about the ease of installation, and never mind the power you had at your disposal, even with the command line. I'm not talking about a GUI now, like GNOME or X-Windows in general, that sort of thing.
GUI anyway, right? It's an operating system.
Exactly, it's an operating system. But the one thing I discovered, you do need internet access for Linux, because otherwise you'll be just. I mean, guys. Listeners, we are talking about the days before Slackware. The first distributions were just emerging. Configuring X11 was still a pain in the butt because you had to fiddle around with mode lines and stuff. Not pleasant. But I finally got it to work on an ancient 386 machine.
Yeah,
and I was pretty impressed.
386 was, I think, my first Linux installation with Fedora. But I couldn't tell you what year that was. It took a number of CDs, if I recall correctly.
As a matter of fact, when we set up shop, when we set up shop, that was the first, I think, our internet-based marketing agency in Dublin at the time, around 95. I made a point of importing the first Slackware CD, apparently, according to lore, into Ireland. That was my kind of first commercial brush with Linux, and I've been using Linux ever since in varying capacities. Linux now drives around 100% of my ARM cores, which there are quite a few around, and the ones that are not using Android are using something called Alarm, which is of course Arch Linux for ARM. I'm an Arch package maintainer. I helped to establish a Linux user group in Frankfurt around 2011. The LUG itself in Frankfurt dates back to late 90s, but it was only instantiated as a formal association in kind of 2010, 2011. Sorry, before Martin keeps complaining, I mean, 2010, of course, means 2010.
I'll remember. Thank you.
Just in case everybody and anybody is kind of lost here, including the Brits and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, doesn't matter. Yes, so that's my way to open source in a nutshell. Funny enough, when I was doing the PhD, okay, my PhD was about operating systems. We're talking about, as I said, about 25 years back.
Are you sure about this?
Positive.
I thought you mentioned something about nurses the other day.
That was before the PhD.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And that wasn't on a professional basis, I might add.
Ah,
and
that wasn't Martin, study, right.
And as I also said in the dialogue, this
you're
going to
cut this out, are you?
No, I'm not. This is also subject to non-disclosure as a need to know.
I'm sure I understand.
And if you... some editing to be done. Anyway,
yes.
What's the one I'm looking for here? Martin is a potential candidate for my designated author of my biography. And before he hasn't signed this agreement, there won't be any disclosure about these facts. Very important.
Well, does it matter?
If
it gets published after your expiry, then it doesn't matter, surely.
So Martin
planning to do this before?
So apparently Martin has already worked on the contract, which is going to be put on my head shortly, by the sound of it. Nice one. Killed by your co-host. Excellent. The way we like it. Beats wife and
before,
other
school,
significant others by miles.
Yeah.
Killed by your co-host. Excellent.
Next episode.
law enforcement, if you're listening to this, if I'm not around in a couple of years' time, you know who to go after. His name is Martin Visser, and yes, he does live in the UK.
I'm sure I can make up an alibi with some fake record.
excellent. Okay, back to my PhD.
Yes, sorry.
The idea at the time was essentially to do an operating system kernel in contrast to the budding Windows and to Unix that had been around at the time for quite some time. Hmm. If you take a look at the kernel architectures of the time, you had microkernels and you had monolithic kernels. There's a beautiful argument, discussion, battle, if you will, between a guy called Andrew Tannenbaum and a guy called Linus Torvalds on Usenet in the late 90s, discussing the various merits of both approaches.
Okay.
Fun fact, apparently, according to lore, Linux, as in the operating system, started out as a terminal emulator for something called Minix. And Minix, of course, being the microkernel developed by Andrew Tannenbaum and team.
Sorry, before you go into that detail, for those listeners amongst us, would you like to expand a sentence on the difference between monolithic and microkernels?
Yes, no problem. Monolithic kernels have been around since the dawn of time. You're talking about very big code base without, I'm tempted to say, much structure in terms of not more or less independent entities working together to achieve a goal, but rather something monolithic in terms of not broken down into individual functionalities. Mm-hmm. In contrast to this, microkernel operating systems, like the one called Windows these days, or something called Mac OS, because it's underneath the hood is Mac OS is essentially a FreeBSD exactly next step
Claudio,
Claudio, if you're listening, it wouldn't come as a surprise. No, next step, as well as macOS, needless to say, is a FreeBSD underneath the hood. Is a FreeBSD personality running on top of a modified Mark microkernel, and Mark being, of course, the CMU development going back to the early 90s, as in Rick Rashid and friends. And for the listeners interested in the details, there's a previous episode about Next Step and Friends detailing the details of this approach. But suffice it to say, monolithic kernels, the usual suspects like Unix, MVS, for those who care to remember it.
That was IBM, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. Hmm. And BS2000 from Siemens. Microkernels, on the other hand, iOS, macOS, Windows, but also something called VMS, done by Digital, because Dave Cutler and friends apparently did the first commercially available microkernel architecture in the market, going back, I think, to the late 80s or something. Let me put this into the show notes, because there's certainly a Wikipedia page on this. But the idea is basically to separate concerns in a microkernel architecture, to have individual entities working along. So, for example, you typically would have a hardware abstraction, level that would take care of abstracting the hardware. On top of this, you would have processors looking after file systems, scheduling, and so forth. In a monolithic code base, you would have these functionalities all put into one code base, executing as one unified kernel. That is the main difference between microkernel and monolithic architectures. And the idea behind Tigger and Friends, which was the name of the experimental microkernel that we did at Trinity at the time, was essentially to construct a microkernel that was able to adapt to application instructions or behavior at runtime. If you take your typical operating system, you have to use, as being an application, what the operating system offers you. So some operating systems offer hard real-time behavior. Some of them offer soft real-time behavior. Some of them offer multiple processes running at one time. Some of them do not do this. The early Windows versions come to mind, where you were only able to execute a program at a given time, never mind the DOS operating system as issued by Microsoft, late 80s, early 90s, that sort of thing, where you would simply have a command line processor.
DOS is a lot older than that.
Microsoft DOS, as in MS-DOS.
Yeah.
Goes back to the mid-80s, I think.
No. I remember installing it with a bunch of floppies, the DOS 1.0, when I was kind of 16 or something. So that would have been...
83?
I think...
Full disclosure, yeah. Microsoft ripped this off from a different company, and they marketed this off as QDOS, Quick and Dirty Operating System.
Yes.
So like some other projects that Microsoft commercialized, let's put it this way, IBM was looking for some software, they turned to Microsoft, Microsoft didn't have anything in stock. The likes of the founders of CPM, this is my recollection, I'm old, so the details may be shady, the developers of CPM, prevailing operating system at the time, declined to sign an NDA, so IBM turned to Microsoft, and the rest is history. Microsoft was in dire need for an operating system to be running on ADX in terms of either 8 or 16-bit processors coming from Intel, the likes that IBM was just incorporating into something called the PC/ XT, which was all the rage in office environments, kind of early 80s, but they were lacking software. So they turned to Microsoft. Microsoft didn't have anything in stock. They bought it, they modified it, and so MS-DOS came into existence, to cut a long story short. Needless to say, Digital Research, as in DR, copped onto the fact later on that this is a market, issued something called Concurrent CPM, which was, never mind the market share, a great operating system compared to MS-DOS, because with CCPM you were able to run concurrent sessions all onto one computer. So you had true multitasking, multiprocessing on the command line then and there. Trouble is, it wasn't a commercial success.
Yeah. Was it OS 2 that IBM tried to bring out themselves?
That was much later, because something called graphical user interfaces were all the rage. Microsoft came up with Windows 1.0, which essentially was a clumsy GUI on top of Microsoft, on top of MS-DOS. And not multitasking capable, clumsy, bug-ridden to some extent, let's put it this way. Whereas IBM did something from the ground up, from a technology perspective, much more superior, in brackets, full disclosure, my perspective on things, true multitasking.
I think that was a general accepted.
Full disclosure, true multitasking, and Windows didn't even come close at the time. Multi-threading in the mid to late 80s, out of the box. You could, of course, structure your application running on top of OS 2 with multiple threads, something that Windows wasn't even dreaming of at the time. Unfortunately, although the commercial success was somewhat limited, OS 2 died a painful death during the 90s. Because nobody used it anymore. Microsoft contributes to some of the code base, if, as far as I can recall, at least the kernel, because the kernel essentially was something that came later into existence as something that Microsoft called new technology. What they did is they brought in Cutler and friends to do a real operating system, let's put it this way. So protected address spaces, multiprocessing, and all the rest of it running on an Intel architecture. Cutler at the time already had much experiences having developed VMS. And also some people of the original Mark III team joined Microsoft. Rick Rashid probably being the best example. He led the Mark III team at CMU, and he was simply, I wouldn't say poached, but convinced to join Microsoft, moved then on to greater things, but he brought with him quite a few engineering folks who, under the technical supervision, or guidance, let's put it this way, of Cutler, developed something that would turn later into NT3.51, which was the first commercially available version of Windows NT. And we're talking early 90s, mid-90s here, give or take.
Now, before we move on too far, one feature that I remember really well from VMS, which has never been really replicated in other operating systems out of the box, was the file history, which was damn handy when you needed it.
Absolutely. As far as I can recall, you had certain VMS extensions, MVS extensions, sorry, not VMS, but VMS supported this at the time out of the box, yes. Other than that, basically you had to rely on versioning systems on top of operating systems, that's correct, But coming back to my PhD before I conclude this discussion. There was something, yes, Martin, there was indeed. Okay, so the idea was basically you take, in a secured way, the operating system offers you certain tools? No, tools is the wrong word. Certain mechanisms that you can then deploy being an application. So, for example, a real-time application just playing back an audio data stream has certain scheduling requirements in terms of a hard real-time. In terms of a hard real-time requirement. So, if you miss a couple of milliseconds, you'll hear it actually in the audio stream. If you're changing to video, and I'm not talking about a container format now that has video and audio just embedded in it, but I'm just talking about a video data stream, it doesn't make much of a difference if you miss a frame or two, because the human eye will not perceive this. So your scheduling and synchronization policies can be relaxed. This is just an example, Tigger and Friends, that was the name of the experimental microkernel architecture, offered essentially these mechanisms. And it did so using a mechanism called reflection, in terms of you go from your base level to a meta level and then make a decision, and then you go back to the base level and continue executing things. Mm-hmm. Something like Smalltalk introduced kind of early mid-80s in terms of how you would allocate memory, for example, for a class. Smalltalk at the time already supported something called metaclasses that would allow you to modify class behavior before you even instantiate an object. That was pretty advanced. There were a couple of research teams in Japan who did something called, I think, Apertos. If I can find the links, you'll find it in the show notes.
No, this is the first time I heard Smalltalk mentioned since I was at university.
Yes, it's quite funny. Yeah, I mean the aspects go or the fundamentals go back to the kind of early 80s. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, even early Lisp dialects include something similar to a metaclass, if memory serves correct. And you're talking about 60s, 70s, that sort of thing. But then Lisp wasn't probably exactly well known outside certain circles.
Indeed.
Because these days, every Emacs user, of course, knows what Lisp is. And rightly so. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, and with Tigger, as in with a PhD, I was in charge of A, designing, and B, implementing the meta-level architecture. Funny enough, and James Gosling, if you're listening to this, no hard feelings, but if I ever should come across you again, you owe me a beer or two, if not more, because what Java, and James probably would be the prime culprit here, what Java did when they defined something called the Reflection API as part of the JDK 1.5, they took certain aspects more or less right away from the thesis and implemented this. And you're talking about a time span of about 2 to 3 years, give or take. I published a seminal book on the subject in 96, and it appeared in the JDK, I think, around 98, 99, 97, something like this. If I would have patented the IPs, and there we go back to Oracle, I probably would be sitting on a Caribbean island powered by Oracle. Given the history, unfortunately, I didn't. One of the few mistakes in my life that I made. Fair enough, but James, if you listen to this, no hard feelings, water on the bridge, fair enough. If I ever, I think I met the guy at a conference, I can't remember where, but anyway, it doesn't matter. If we meet again, never mind pandemia or not, you owe me a beer, if not more. Anyway, so that was the PhD, long and short, and that was my first kind of exposure in a bigger way than just compiling Emacs on using this as part of a project, because we used Linux as the base operating system to develop and to QA the kernel as in test it, but also used many open source projects on top of Linux to drive this. Initially we looked at Perl for much of the QA framework, but then we decided on something called Python, which at the time had just been developed by a guy called Guido von Rossum. If I understand this correctly, now an avid Rust contributor. Fair enough, Guido. We all have to move on. That's okay. No worries. Never mind PEP 572 or something. I can't remember.
Yeah,
doesn't matter.
I think we should mention this to him. Maybe he'll come on.
Yes, Guido. If you're worrying about the details, if you're looking for the details, just check out the two bumper episodes that we did on Python. The details are in there. Okay. Anyway, doesn't matter. So that was my first brush with Python, and I've stuck with the language more or less ever since, Rust or not. As a matter of fact, much of the ecosystem driving Linux in laws, the bits you don't see when you go to the website, are written in Python. But enough of that. The whole concept then, and it still does to me today, still appeals to me. But early 90s, or mid-90s rather, the ecosystem was much less developed because we're talking about Python version 1 instead of version 2 and version 3. Pip, as in PyPy, wasn't even on the horizon then. But still, I found the language still powerful enough to drive this and to support us in that endeavor. In terms of getting an experimental microkernel architecture up and running, full disclosure, that was an EU-funded project. Quite a few companies were part of the consortium. For example, there were a couple of German game companies that were looking at the microkernel to deploy this as part of their gaming infrastructure. Not sure what came out of it because I left Trinity in 96. So maybe if you buy a German game from the likes of what's the name of that Frankfurt developer, Cryo or something? Exactly, Cryo Engine. Yeah, maybe underneath there's still a microkernel running done by Trinity. I don't know. Simply, or maybe Cryo has done their own engine and I'm just doing injustice to them. Anyway, long story short, if I may put in some pointers to research papers that are published, but given the fact that this is not a Chris Zimmerman show, as in terms of I have to keep my vanity in check, I just may decide on not doing this. That's okay. But for those of you who cannot sleep at night, let me put the link to that seminal textbook in the show notes. So if you're still up at 1 a.m., just read it and you'll be asleep in no time. No worries.
Would you like to expand where the name Tigger came from as well?
All of the sub-projects had Disney names. Okay. And Tigger being the metal architecture that I didn't implement it. There was
an acronym for something else.
Yeah, no, okay. It's not. No.
I'm trying to work it out. What that,
no, yeah, at Disney, if you're listening... it never made it into commercial fruition as the character, so don't even get the lawyers on the case. There's no point. Exactly, no, there's not. We're talking about 25 years back. Do your numbers.
Very good.
But if you're so inclined, Martin is still looking for a Disney Plus subscription. So if you're game, just send him the access code.
Feel free. I'm sure the kids will appreciate it.
Indeed. Okay. Given the fact that this was meant to be about 20 minutes.
Yes.
Yes, we are now are kind of touching about 50 minutes. I think this is time to wrap this up, right?
Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to... This is only halfway, really, right, isn't it?
So that was our road to open source, I think.
It was, yes.
So all that needs to be done still is the feedback.
We have some
feedback, yes.
We have feedback from...
Brian writes in saying, why... Sorry, Martin, you were saying?
We have feedback from Brian and
yes.
Ahuka.
So
go for it.
Ahuka. I always butchered this name. So let's go through Ahuka first. You want to read this, Martin?
Sure. So, comment by Ahuka on episode number 12. Excellent interview. I really enjoyed the interview with Randall Swartz. More of this would be great.
So, Ahuka, thank you very much. And also full credit because it's the Ahuka from Hacker Public Radio that does all these wonderful GIMP episodes. I'm sure, Martin, you have listened to them, right?
I am. Not all of them, but it's a very handy a bit of...
Yes.
Intro to GIMP, if you're not
familiar. Yes, I especially like the episode on the time warp operator. Plugin.
Episode on the t-shirt making activity.
Ahuka, I really like this because apparently it allows you to draw an image in GIMP in the past. That's excellent. Anyway, let's not get distracted by this. Ahuka, sorry. We reserve the right to make fun at at certain feedback. That doesn't mean that we don't love feedback. It's just basically a matter of making the show a little bit lively. And but Ahuka, of course, your feedback is welcome. And yes, we do appreciate the work on GIMP.
Welcome and appreciate it. Feedback.
Yes, indeed. Yes. So another chap wrote in called Brian. Let me read this out. Subject is Merlin, and the feedback is: Why did you not ask Randall? For those of your audience that don't participate in Twitter, could you summarize what happened at Frost Weekly, and what looked like a hostile takeover of the show? That's the quote in the feedback. End of quote. You missed an opportunity because Dan Lynch won't talk. I emailed him, and I can't find his blog Twitter post that explains Leo showing Randall the door. If there is a link to this, please put it in the show notes. From Brian in Ohio. Brian, first of all, thank you very much for the comment, but you are maybe right that the perception may be a different one from the outside. Randall, in preparation of the show, Randall and the two of us spoke, what we should basically cover and what we shouldn't cover. And Randall was quite, I wouldn't say clear, but Randall said that the separation between him and Twit was mutual and was also done in a friendly way. You can actually see this if you take a look at a post that Leo put on, I think, the Twittery blog. You'll find the link, of course, in the show notes.
Show notes, indeed.
Yes, where he actually thanks Randall for, I think, 10 years of service or something like this. So clearly, it's not a hostile takeover of Doc Searle's running Floss Weekly. It's just a matter of changing hosts, and that's exactly what happened. But as I said, the departure was quite friendly, at least according to that blog post that Leo did. Dan Lynch, I don't know. He's still active. Spoke to him a while back. As in the in-laws, have learned a grateful lot of the Outlaws, because this is basically, of course, as most of our listeners may or may not know, Dan Lynch and Fab Scherchel were the original hosts of something called Linux Outlaws that we simply took as an inspiration for this show, as in the Linux In-Laws, by saying that we are more than happy to continue the legacy, only slightly tweaked.
Only a little bit.
Only a little bit, yeah. And before I forget, yes, that was the feedback. So, yes, feedback is welcome. You can send us feedback by simply mailing to feedback.
Or commenting on the...
Yes, I was just about...
HPR feed.
Yes, always two options.
Indeed.
Yeah. The mail address for feedback is feedback@linuxinlaws.eu. And you simply can enter a comment on the corresponding episode on Hacker Public Radio. Goes without saying. One thing, Martin. Accounts got in touch, before I forget. Something a little bit on the internal side of Linux Inlaws. But Evelyn from Accounts got in touch, and she wasn't happy that apparently you tried to expense an escort service once again.
Well, it's not my job to keep accounts happy. Obviously.
Martin, sorry, we spoke about this, right? You cannot expense escort services.
Ah, I see. I was taking an example from your nurses episode.
There is no nurses episode. This is just make believe, right?
This is to be continued, dear listeners.
I'm just looking at the receipt here, Martin, that you filed with the expense claim, and it spoke. I mean, 500 quid for special services? Are you joking me? Was it worth
special
it?
Special services, yeah. Well, the SAS, yeah, they're obviously required for certain duties.
No, I'm talking about the escort bill.
Oh, I need escorting through the airports, yeah, for my personal safety.
Hang on, there's a QR code on this. Let me go to the website, basically, because the invoice only speaks about special services. Martin, 500 quid? Great. Obviously, because although this podcast is explicit, I cannot really read out loud what's on the webpage that I'm looking at. Okay, Martin, for future reference, we do have a corporate account at an escort service. It's called Rainbow Escorts. It may not be as fancy as the one you used, But
this is the one you set up. Excellent.
Just use labels. They have a corporate account with us. Oh, sorry, we have a corporate account with them.
Our bank account is at the current level, is it?
Just basically use Rainbow Escorts. That'll do the trick nicely, Martin. Don't try to expense other escort services, because in that case it's official, because you have to put it through claims, whereas you simply go to Rainbow Escorts, put make an appointment on the website, and then we do it differently. Okay?
I see.
Perfect. No,
I'll consider this. Talking about bank accounts, apparently the Rust Project needs a bank account as well.
Do they? Why?
Because they want to start a foundation?
Indeed!
Foundations need bank accounts.
So, people, if you have surplus money sitting around, lying on the sofa or something, check out the blog post on rust-lang.org. Yes, the employees, the core community, in collaboration, I think, with the Mozilla Foundation, or what's left of it, want to start a Rust Lang Foundation, as in a foundation looking after the development and maybe also marketing of a programming language called Rust.
More on that in the next episode.
Indeed. Or the one after, depending.
No, it's the next one, 1st September.
Yes, but this is not 15, but rather 16. Sorry, this is 15, not 14. This is episode 13, Martin.
Yes,
next
14,
one will be
14 is worse than Python and Co.
No, that would be 15, because 14 will be about IT security, where Martin will explain to us all these wonderful IT security things.
No. Incorrect.
Why?
No, this is 13. 14 is correct. The 1st of September Rust Python thing. Then we have IT security, and then we have Nextcloud. Aha.
I thought we would do it the other way around. Anyway, for the upcoming episodes, people, we will cover the great battle between Rust, C++, maybe, and of course Python. We may post this as an episode 14.
It will be an episode of a certain number.
After that, we have lined up a show on IT security, where Martin will basically show us how to not file expense claims for escort services, but rather do it in a different way. And of course, also we have lined up Frank Harlicek and other guys. Frank Harlicek, of course, of Nextcloud fame. So it's going to be a little bit of a bumper autumn for Linus in-laws. And of course, we plan to do a Halloween special. Meaning we're gonna answer all your questions that you have.
As long as they're scary. We're not going to answer unscary questions, sorry.
So if you send us in questions, please ensure that they at least sound scary. Whether they have to be or not is a different story, but just make it sound like they are scary. So instead of saying, now look, what happens if I assign 0 to a variable and then use that variable as a pointer for variable access, as in I'm trying to get a value from address 0, that normally results in a segmentation fault on Linux. Just say, why did the world stop because my app was crashing because of a simple pointer problem? That will ensure that you get past the guards, especially the ones called Martin Visser. Okay, guys, that's all for episode... Martin, which episode is it?
Currently on 13, yeah.
Excellent!
Next one will be 14.
That's all for episode 13. As usual, you can find us on Hacker Public Radio. Yes, and of course, we do have a Google podcast feed now.
We do.
Martin, you want to talk about this before we wrap up the show?
Yes, our RSS feed is up, and we are on Google Podcasts. Cannot find Hacker Public Radio.
And thanks to Martin for writing the Python code behind the RSS magic.
This was some existing bits of code you nicked from somewhere.
Perfect. This is, of course, the great philosophy behind open source. You just steal somebody else's code and just hope it works.
Well, okay. Probably fix it is more like it, isn't it?
Anyway, now you find us on Google Podcasts. We are also in the app. Simply type in Linux in-laws, and then you can subscribe to the show. We are on Hacker Public Radio and will be for the time being. Should we change this, you'll be the first to know on this particular show here, as in we will announce it here first. But until such time, we would like to thank Hacker Public Radio. Mm. Ken and friends, you're doing an excellent job, and continue and keep up the good work. And that's all for episode 13. Bye, people.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Solid Market, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.